Welcome to The Great Exchange, a podcast about examining the lies that we believe and exchanging them for God's truth. I'm your host, Brady Cohn, and joining me today as our guest from Grand Junction, Colorado, Michael Costello. How are you doing today, Michael?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Absolutely. So let me just tell everyone a little bit about you, Michael. You, like I said, live in Grand Junction, Colorado. I met you through a ministry you're involved with at the university there in Grand Junction, and you are probably one of the smartest people that I know. And I was really encouraged by a lot of what you had to contribute to the conversation. You had a whole career in physics and working in research with chemistry and material science. And now you do professional counseling. You have several master's degrees. You're obviously just very well educated. You work in the mental health field and deal with substance abuse, family issues. And recently, I know you've dealt with a lot more situations with families within the court system where a child has, you know, declared themselves as being transgender. So you've had to walk through that very personally in some really difficult situations. And you also do a lot of counseling within your church. You love Jesus. You're an elder at your church there in the Grand Junction area. And so you just bring a lot of different expertise and different ways of viewing these issues from a much more clinical, educated standpoint than I do. So I have no doubt that we will be blessed by that.
Well, I hope so. And again, I really appreciate the chance to join you on the show here.
Absolutely. So one of the big raging topics of the day is transgenderism, and we've seen so many things just blow up recently, but the boycott with Bud Light, now there's Target with their gender affirming, clothing, and just so many situations that are just blowing up in our culture. And so this is a topic we need to be educated on, but gender dysphoria itself is not a new diagnosis. It's not a new issue. It's been around for a while. It just has been a little bit snowballing the last few years and taking on kind of a social contagion aspect. And so can you just give us a little bit of the history of the mental health diagnosis of gender dysphoria and then maybe how that's changed and evolved over the decades?
Yes. Kind of looking at this from the standpoint of the American Psychiatric Association, they published the Bible for mental health diagnoses, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And the first volume that they published was in 1952, and there was nothing in it actually about gender dysphoria or identity concerns. The first time anything like that appeared in the official DSM was in 1980, when it was called Gender Identity Disorder. In 2013, they changed the name of it to gender dysphoria. So as far as it being on the radar, as kind of a widespread issue within the mental health field, it's really fairly recent, just something that's been in the last 30 or 40 years advertised to practitioners in general, if you will. And really, it's been in the last 10, 20 years that it's really taking off in terms of the number of people that are coming in for help because they're not comfortable about their bodies or their, what sex their body is and what their emotions are like when they think about that.
Absolutely. So what is an actual definition of gender dysphoria? When we hear that term, what does that actually mean? We say that someone has gender dysphoria.
Right now, the guidelines for diagnosing this is to say that somebody has a very strong sense. It's not really defined whether it's an emotion or a cognitive sense, but they have a very strong sense that their real self is not the same gender or the same sex as their body. And if that is something that's been persistent in their life for many years, we're told to give that the diagnosis of gender dysphoria.
I see. And so we see this concept of gender dysphoria, like you said, really increasing the last few years. And we have all these people coming out as trans, and we see gender affirming care. Exactly what is gender affirming care? What all does it encompass? And we've talked about that a little bit on the podcast and some previous episodes with a like a pediatrician, but from a clinical standpoint, what is the concept of gender affirming care that's being really pushed on and advocated for in our culture?
The majority of therapists I know and the training that's advertised to me is for the gender affirming care is the step one is to just assume that if somebody is saying, "Hey, I'm in the wrong body," that's 100% accurate statement. And there's no encouragement to explore why do you think that? Where is this coming from? How long has it been there, really? But to just assume right off, yes, you're definitely an individual who is in the wrong body. And there, in the therapy office, there's a short initial engagement with the client. It would be one or two sessions, and then we're told to sign a form that would authorize the client to start receiving a hormone treatment, that is to get the hormone of the other sex than what their body is, to try and make them feel more at home and to start causing changes in the body.
Yeah, and so that seems to be really concerning that they're making it so easy to receive gender affirming care, including like cross sex hormones, puberty blockers, and where just one or two visits with a counselor and they sign off on the form. And so we're told that there's safeguards in place, yet some of those safeguards are so lax that just, anyone who just says, "Oh, I'm transgender and I'm, supposed to be a different gender," it's extremely, extremely easy then to get signed off to receive, very intensive treatment and medical intervention to start the kind of transition process. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, that is. In fact, it's very difficult to find treatment other than the gender affirming care right now. Though that is something that several countries around the world are saying we must start implementing because the gender affirming care just is not working. The outcomes are not good.
Yeah, what are you seeing in that area? And I feel like this is an area where our society has been so hijacked by ideology that there's so many in denial about the fact that gender transitions is not working for people. It's not giving people peace. Suicide rates are actually increasing the further someone gets in the process. And so it's not working. And, several of the countries, like you mentioned, that were really on the forefront of gender transitions are all of a sudden stopping doing them because they're seeing that it's not being successful. And so why do you think that there's just such a die hard, almost like militant attitude towards this concept of anyone who makes any claim that they're transgender, we have to immediately do these, medical interventions for them and take them down this process of gender affirming care, even though it's not showing to be working. Why do you see that happening in our culture? Do you have any thoughts for us?
Well, yes, one of the big things is the big reasons, I guess, it's not widely publicized, even among mental health practitioners, that the data shows long term this really is not helping and is more likely than not doing harm to people who receive the hormone treatment and the surgical transitioning. There was a study that just came out with, it was Levine and Abrasia, who had noticed that or noted that the primary things driving this approach to care are a number of beliefs about people who express this gender dysphoria that are just plain false. It's a false belief that someone who does not get this care is very likely to commit suicide. Especially among the very young, it's true that if they're not receiving this gender affirmation care, they're doing more of a psychotherapeutic exploration of where these feelings are coming from, that the vast majority come to being at peace with who they are and what body they have right now.
And I think that that's a very powerful point because what I see so many times is parents and other people backed into a corner and said, if you don't immediately affirm your child's gender, dysphoria and transition, then they're going to commit suicide. And I see the phrase, with being told to parents who have a daughter who with gender dysphoria saying, well, would you rather have a son who's alive or a daughter who's dead? Because it's the assumption, they're telling them an assumption that if you don't affirm them in their gender affirming care and their transgenderism, they will commit suicide as if that's a fact. But that's not what actual science shows, is it? It's showing that if you work through the source of those feelings, which is what, counseling and mental health care should do, that most can move on and accept the body that they have.
Yes, in the again, the overwhelming majority of cases, that is the outcome for people who avoid jumping right into the hormone treatment and instead start to explore again through traditional psychotherapeutic methods. Why am I thinking this? Why am I feeling this? What are alternatives? Not everyone who does receive the psychotherapeutic care will come to the conclusion that they can be at home in their own body, but the vast majority will.
Yeah, and I think we've been so quick to put people in a box and tell them that they're transgender. And I've worked with a lot of now detransitioners who detransitioned, and many times they were told it's like, oh, you're 13 years old, you're going through puberty. If you don't feel comfortable in your body, it means you're transgender. It's like, well, what 13-year-old really feels comfortable in their body? There's all this change happening. It's awkward and it's weird and there's these social dynamics. And so what they need is to be shepherded through that, and not put into this box that says, well, you're transgender and here's this, hormone therapies that will fix the problem for you, when we're seeing that that's it doesn't actually fix the problem. Many times it causes a lot of long-term heartache and pain as they are making changes to their body that can never be undone.
Yes. Then again, being told that this is a fix, it is a lie. And again, the vast majority of cases, at the best, best cases, you stay about where you were beforehand with your mental health. A lot more often, we see people's mental health deteriorate.
Yeah, which is a tragic and sad reality, and we should be on our knees praying for these people.
Amen. It's a horrible thing to go through. A belief that I'm literally built to be at war with myself. It's a horrid thing to hear. You talk about someone is saying, "Hey, here I am. I'm starting puberty." In some cases, they've even worked with children who are still prepubescent. They haven't begun puberty. But are thinking, well, that's when they'll block the hormones so that puberty cannot begin. But in all of these instances, there is an emotional distress that the child or the adult individual is feeling that is never addressed. There's never a the protocol for gender affirming care is not to say, okay, so you're depressed. And you think that's coming from this, or you've been self-harming, and you think that's because here's what's because you're in the wrong body. Well, let's look at that. What is it that makes you think that it's It's related to what body you're in. What do you not like about it? A lot of times someone starting puberty has this picture of, okay, now I'm going to be the next, great American sex symbol. And that's just not the reality. Puberty takes years to complete, and it does weird things to your voice and your emotions and your complexion. So this the reality compared to what someone pictures is naturally going to create a certain amount of dissatisfaction with how puberty starts.
And it's so sad to see kids go through this process where they should be shepherded and learning to love their body that God created for them. Instead, they're being told that they should be at war with their body, that your body isn't right, your body isn't good enough, and you need to make all these changes to your body. And that's a tragic reality to impress upon our kids. One reality that I'm seeing that in our culture the last few years is there's a big insurgence of what is called rapid onset gender dysphoria, where it seemed like it used to be the people with gender dysphoria who were transitioning. It had been a very long held, deep internal wrestling for many, many years, and now it's something that happens much more suddenly, which points to, in many ways, the reality of it being more of a social contagion, that ideas are planted in their mind. Many times they're celebrated for coming out as transgender. And so I have some statistics and some information from Preston Sprinkle's book recently called Embodied. And so this is a survey done amongst parents of teenagers with rapid onset gender dysphoria. Several of the common factors that parents talked about was that there was little or no gender dysphoria as children, and so it happened very, rapidly. It appeared very suddenly. Many times their friends were coming out as trans. Many became more popular at school after coming out as trans. They engage in heavy online and social media activity, much more than normal, around their kind of coming out. And many had other mental health concerns which were not being dealt with. And I have a whole list of some of those mental health concerns. But I think that some of those common factors from the survey of parents really points to a lot of the social contagion aspect, and especially when it comes to like social media. I know so many parents involved in our parents ministry whose kids had experienced no gender dysphoria until they got heavily persuaded by people on TikTok. And it's kind of like there was this, aspect of being uncomfortable with themselves, looking for an identity, looking for a place of belonging and acceptance. And all of a sudden, these different influencers on social media come along and convince them that the solution to your problem is to be transgender, and that's a place where you can belong. And kids are desperate for that, and they buy into that. And it's tragic to see these kids that were living relatively healthy lives, obviously had some type of issue to be considering these things, be susceptible to it, but then all of a sudden, very quickly, go down this road that takes them to a very unhealthy place mentally and emotionally.
Yes, and that really started to come on around 2014, 2015. It was a couple years after the diagnosis was officially changed to a dysphoria instead of a gender identity disorder. There's a lady named Jamie Reed who recently wrote an article about her experience working in a center where they did the hormone treatment and set people up for the surgical treatments that would follow. And she said she saw this around 2014, 2015, that where they go from one or two referrals a month, most of the young boys, they would start to get 10, 12 people coming in a month, the vast majority of them young girls. And her initial thought is this has got to be social contagion. There is no other reasonable explanation for why this many people in the culture all of a sudden are thinking that that they're trapped in the wrong body.
Yeah. And, our society is so insistent that anyone in the LGBTQ community of this is natural and normal and this is who you're supposed to be. But if it was dictated by biology, you would not see such rapid change in identities and these different categories. And so that points to a lot more emotional, social aspects of it. I would like to go through this list of people, list of the survey with people who have experienced rapid onset gender dysphoria, and it really points to how they've already had mental health issues they're struggling with, and that makes them more susceptible. And so let me just go through this list really quick. Out of teenagers who experience rapid onset gender dysphoria, 48% experienced a traumatic or stressful event prior to their gender dysphoria. And so to me, that in itself is really telling that there is some trauma. And whenever we go through trauma, we have different ways of dealing with it. And society offers us escapes for our trauma. And different generations have different vices. And in the past, it might have been pornography or alcohol or dressing, promiscuity, and all these kind of sin issues that are kind of an escape to deal with the reality and the hurt and the pain and the trauma. So to me, that's really heartbreaking that so many teenagers with gender dysphoria had experienced trauma in their life prior to that. And 45% were engaged in self-harm, like cutting, self-injury prior to gender dysphoria. And so those two statistics in itself are huge, and it goes to show that there's some distress going on that needs to be dealt with in a healthy way, and maybe the gender dysphoria is a result of unresolved events and conflict in their life.
Yeah, or even a sense of, well, not this trauma has made me different. It somehow separated me from my community. What do I do about that? People will take on new identities when they feel cut off from their old life in some way or another. And traumas will often do that, especially if it's been a trauma within the family, where there's a sense that something so horrible has happened that I don't belong here anymore. I just don't fit in. When people have been victimized by close friends or family members, they do question their own worth and really their own identity. And if we hand you in a neat package, oh, hey, that's probably a problem with your sexual identity, and here's some injections that'll make the problem go away. It's very easy for people to start pursuing that quick sense of relief and of acceptance in a new community with their real sense of who they are.
Absolutely. Another statistic that I found alarming was that 12% of teenagers with rapid onset gender dysphoria were on the autism spectrum, which is 10 times higher than the general population. And I've ministered to a lot of parents whose kids were LGBTQ or are LGBTQ, many of them transgender, who are on the autism spectrum. And it seems like, the autism had caused some social issues. Many kids on the autism spectrum have a hard time understanding and navigating social situations, and they have a hard time feeling like they belong. And so it's really tragic to see these kids who are already have a reality that's difficult for them, and then people come along and tell them that transgenderism is the solution and they can belong there, and they seem to be kind of duped into it. And and have a hard time processing and understanding who is telling me the truth and kind of what is reality. And to me, that's makes my heart grieve for those kids who are already in a place of having some difficult circumstances.
Yes, and, you know, the autism spectrum disorders tend to be caught fairly young. So these are children who have been usually raised in an environment where they're spending a certain amount of their time during school with a professional treatment provider who's telling them, well, these are things that are true about you, and these are ways that you need to do things differently so you can navigate these social challenges.
And they've grown up feeling like they're different than everyone else. They're a little bit separated and can't relate, and they're separated from the rest of their peers. So that in itself would give them a feeling of I don't quite belong.
Yes. Well, and, you know, pre-pubic, kids tend to be a lot more accepting of these kinds of differences in each other. And you still get bullying and that happens in first, second, third grade. But generally, there's more acceptance of, oh, this person has that disorder, they're a little different. Okay. As soon as puberty hits, all of us who've been through this know that overnight, social cliques change, social acceptance and rules of belonging change. You know, somebody that was your best friend at the end of sixth grade, after the summer is over and you go back to fall of seventh grade and you're both hormonally deranged, it suddenly it's not my friend anymore. I'm not good enough. I'm rejected because I'm socially embarrassing. And children on the autism spectrum disorder are far more likely to fall into that category of people who are being rejected and pushed out of the social circles that they had formed, and you know, start having to look for new friends and new contacts. And that's a lot more challenging to navigate for someone with an autism spectrum disorder.
Michael, in your line of work, you also work sometimes with the court system, helping the court system navigate family issues. And sometimes those family issues are, you know, children who come out as transgender and the parents, you know, disagree on how to process it. I also see a lot of what's very concerning is gender transitions being pushed on very young kids. And I don't know if you've dealt with those situations specifically, but like, you know, parents who are like 3 or 4 years, have kids who are 3 or 4 years old claiming that my child is transgender and my boy is being raised as a girl because, you know, he liked a doll. And so they say, well, he's transgender. And to me, that's really, really tragic and abusive, and that child does not have the capacity to even understand what that is. Do you see that a lot, either in your practice or even just in culture? I've definitely been made aware of many of those situations, and I see it being touted by parents. I don't know if you've come across any of those situations.
I have. And the 3 and 4 is an extremely young age. And those are cases where I've heard about them. And I've heard about parents, it seems like, leveraging that to become TikTok influencers of their own. But the youngest that I've encountered in my own practice was a child who was 7. And, I approach these things with what I call gender identity therapy. Well, not what I call, what is called gender identity therapy rather than the affirmation therapy.
So what does that look like then? Maybe you've already kind of explained that in the conversation, but actually affirming the gender that God created them to be and actually doing some therapeutic, you know, processes with them that get to the root of why they're feeling what they're feeling. Is that kind of the process that you take them down?
Yes, and it age dependent how many of the initial tools you'll use. I'm so sorry there. But we start with just asking people to think about and consider, well, what kinds of sexual experiences have you had? What do they mean to you? What kind of attraction do you experience? Have you acted on these things? There's a lot of just, let's think through how did you get here? How did you feel in a situation when you were rejected and those sorts of things?
Yeah, and figuring out different layers of someone's heart that and experiences that has affected them. And even though you're doing it in a professional setting, that's so much of discipleship, or should be discipleship, of figuring out what are the deep layers of my heart, what experiences have affected me, what maybe lies have I believed because of those experiences, what misperceptions do I have about myself and about the world. That's discipleship, and that's how we get to the root of what's causing issues in our life, and that's where we see success in the ministry world, and but also in more of a clinical counseling world like you're in.
Yes, and in both of those, we have to start by being very good listeners. So it's not just a knee-jerk reaction of, oh, wait, no, that can't be. Just look in the mirror. You're obviously not a boy or girl, depending on your inclination here. But there really is a start with, boy, I get this. This has got to be eating you up that you're feeling this kind of upset about a different situation.
Absolutely. And I see so many Christians just try to put out, simple one-liners that completely dismiss people's struggle. Like a meme that will, they put out statements, let's say, oh, there's only two genders, man and woman, end of discussion. It's like that's not actually helping anyone who's wrestling with deep issues. And it's not convincing anyone who has gender dysphoria that which route they should go down in receiving care for that.
Right. And even saying there are only two genders, it's not the end of the discussion. It has to be the beginning. Someone, who's presenting as with gender dysphoria, with the sense that I have the wrong body for my gender, they believe in two genders. They're just not comfortable with the one that their body says they have.
Yeah, we can make a true statement like that, but that we also have to apply that truth to people's lives, which happens in relationships, whether it's friendship, discipleship, or more of a clinical setting. It's like we have to try to understand deeply what's going on in someone's life so that we can apply the truth and we can help them work through, lies that they've believed and, have a kind of changed heart.
Yes. Well, and even if it's not in a formal discipleship setting, but just, I'm at school, my friend comes and tells me, hey, I think I might really be the other sex from what I look like. Just to be able to know, I've heard there's a different way of approaching this than jumping right into hormone treatment. Maybe we could find somebody who does this gender identity therapy that can help you really understand yourself better, and hopefully know how to, whether it's chasing down the hormone surgical route or pursuing some much more likely to succeed route, someone who can help you to be comfortable with you again.
Absolutely. And we are in Pride Month now, and I know that Christians get frustrated at seeing our culture and feel like, all this is shoved down our throats. But my prayer is that we can see people and not just see political movements or ideology or corporations, but we can see these as people who are struggling, who need the hope of the gospel, who need reality in their life, who, sometimes need a friend, and really need someone to listen and give them a place where they can belong, where they can be loved.
Yes. Yeah, just like shaming a Christian for having traditional beliefs doesn't do any good. For the Christian to turn around and shame someone else who is going through a real struggle with their own identity, it does no good and it does harm. I don't know how you'd compare the shaming approach to the hormone treatment approach, but neither one of them has been shown to do good, and both definitely do harm. We don't need to engage in either one.
Michael, I so much appreciate all of your insight. And like I said, I still believe that you're one of the smartest people I know. And so I so much appreciate your insight. I appreciate your involvement in college ministry there in Grand Junction and just these well-thought conversations and your knowledge and your heart for people. So I really appreciate you joining us. Do you have anything you'd like to close with? When people think of gender dysphoria, is there anything else you think that they really need to know and how to navigate this in our culture right now?
But I think number one is really kind of pounding home that affirmation therapy is not the only option, and all the data indicates it's probably a harmful option. On another topic, when you say I'm one of the smartest guys you know, I think the listeners should know that last time I talked to you, you were out amongst a bunch of little burros. So I guess if I'm being compared to the donkeys, I mean, maybe my IQ beats them, right?
Yes, we do love our little donkeys at my house. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of The Great Exchange. We pray that as you go throughout your week, you can examine the lies you've believed and exchange them for God's truth. Let's handle these issues with compassion and grace. And if you're looking for more resources, check out calibrateministries.com. Thank you so much for joining us.